You are listening to the Professional Education Broadcast Network. Thank you for joining us for Buying and Selling Commercial Real Estate Part 1. I'm pleased to introduce our speakers. Joining us from Philadelphia is Richard Goldberg. Mr. Goldberg is a retired partner of Ballard Spahr LLP. Mr. Goldberg has more than 40 years' experience in real estate, in law practice, and with a major national developer. He is past president of the American College of Real Estate Lawyers and past chair of the Anglo-American Real Property Institute. He is also a fellow of the American College of Mortgage Attorneys. Mr. Goldberg will serve as the leader of today's program. Joining us from Houston is John Holyfield. For 26 years, Mr. Holyfield was a partner and is now a counsel in the Houston office of Norton Rose Fulbright LLP. He has an extensive practice focusing on real estate development, mortgage lending, and commercial leasing. He formerly served as the chair of ABA section on real property, probate, and trust law. Mr. Holyfield also was president of the American College of Real Estate Lawyers and served as the chair of the Anglo-American Real Property Institute. Joining us from Chicago is Anthony Licata. Mr. Licata is a partner at Taft, Centinius & Hollister LLP, where he formerly chaired the firm's real estate practice. He has an extensive practice focusing on major commercial real estate transactions, including finance, development, leasing, and land use. He formerly served as the adjunct professor at the Kellogg Graduate School of Management at Northwestern University and at the Illinois Institute of Technology. Mr. Goldberg, I hand the program over to you.
Well, thank you very much and welcome, everybody. Today's program is the first of two, and we're going to be discussing today buying and selling commercial real estate, planning the transaction, letters of intent, income-producing properties and their special issues, due diligence, deposits, and then financing contingencies. It's a fairly full program, and we will march our way through it. Let's talk about planning the transaction. And the way we're going to do this is the three of us are going to really have a discussion, and we will be happy to answer your questions when this is over. My sense of planning the transaction is a client rushes into my office, throws something on my desk and says, I need to buy this as soon as possible. That's planning the transaction. However, if I do get more time to deal with it, I really just go through my mind the steps that we're going to go over with you today. What do you need to do to acquire this piece of property? And the initial question is, what is it? And when I say what is it, are you buying land? Are you buying improved property? If so, what kind of improved property are you buying? Is it a hotel? Is it a shopping center? Is it an office building? Is it a multifamily project? Is it an industrial project? Because each of these require a specific kind of knowledge and a slightly different, and in some cases not so slightly when you're dealing with things like hotels, approach toward the performance of the transaction. So you need to sit down with your client and do that. The other thing I find useful in planning the transaction is I really need to have an in-depth interview with the client about what their objectives are. Are they in this to hold for a long time? Are they in this to buy and flip? Do they have partners? And if so, what are the partners' objectives? And above all, and most importantly, is do the two parties, if you have two parties who are, independent, and by the way, you can represent, represententing the deal is something that we all want to spend a little bit of time on. It's something I'm really not terribly happy about. I will represent my client and may take the lead in the negotiation of the deal, but I do not want to represent two partners in a deal, particularly in the formation of the partnership agreement. That is kind of death warmed over. There's an old New Jersey case that says if you do that, you have violated the canons of ethics and you can get sued and lose a lot of money. So it really is kind of significant to sit down with your client and try to analyze their objectives. Tony or John, do you have any other thoughts on that and how we plan it out?
I agree with everything you said. And by the way, Dick, those issues apply whether you mentioned buying a property, same identical issues on selling a property. Got all those same questions have to be worked through. What I try to do initially in a planning process, and John, you can chime in here too, I focus initially very quickly on what I call the long lead time items. You've got to, whether you're buying or you're selling, you're going to need a survey, a title report. There's the PZR company zoning report you typically need to get, environmental report, payoff letters sometimes from the lender, other lender requirements they may have if you're on the buy side, or a payoff letter if you're on the sell side. And everybody's busy, especially in the current favorable economic conditions, and it can take weeks, literally, or longer sometimes, to get all these items lined up. So I'm a great believer, guys, in creating a closing checklist early on, getting all these long lead items up at the top of it, making sure that they're all on track, and then we're bringing all these down towards the closing date.
I think that I agree with you, Tony, and that's particularly true. You know, I always think of the surveyor. Their motto is call me first, and I'll be the last to produce. It's not that I don't dislike them. It's just as their job is long, and in a busy market, you really have to take your turn. Tony's absolutely right. You need to look at what's going to take me the longest, and therefore what should I be doing? Clearly, until you get a contract of sale, you don't start doing a survey for two reasons. Number one, the issue of spending money on something that may not happen, but even more importantly, number two, getting the appropriate access to the property when you don't have a contract of sale and people start to see surveyors, they know something's happening. So I think it's really important that you plot out when and why you do things. Your client will not appreciate you spending a lot of money on a transaction that is not fully documented and in essence, I won't say sewn up, because they're sewn up when the deed gets recorded. But some of the things Tony mentioned can be quite expensive, and your clients don't really want you to spend the dough. So I think that is an important piece of this.
Correct. And Dick, if you're not yet in contract and the client isn't willing to authorize these expenditures prior to the contract, one of the reasons to lay out those timelines is that the clients are often, and John, I don't know your experience, the clients are often very unrealistic about how long some of this can take, and they don't give you realistic timelines in the contract. They'll say we're going to have so many days for due diligence and closing so many days after that, and those timelines have got to line up in the real world with the delivery dates that you think you can get all this stuff done.
Yeah, hopefully they will come to you and have you negotiate the contract, although I have had situations where, in fact, they have thrown it on the table. The nice part about it, when I was an in-house lawyer doing major malls and hotels, was that I was part of the planning process from the beginning, so they knew enough not to start to do things until I was around. But once I went into private practice, that was really a very, very different animal. The client will have done stuff without you, so that's something you have to take into consideration. Let's move on a little bit to the letters of intent, one of my most and least favorite subjects. John, do you want to talk a little bit about letters of intent? John? Did we lose John? Tony, are you there?
Can you hear me?
No, now I can.
I'm sorry?
Now I can hear you.
Okay, all right. I wanted to make one quick point before we go to the letters of intent, and that is try to get a good handle from the client on what it is that you're buying. Typically, they're a building or even a piece of land has more complications to it than might appear on the surface. So getting a good understanding of what it is that's being bought will give you some help whenever you're drafting the contract in terms of describing what it is that the contract covers or doesn't cover. Okay, letters of intent. One of the things that can get you into a lot of trouble, and I have waxed long and hard from time to time about these things, the longer they get, probably the less effective they are and the more expensive they are for the client. The shorter they are, they probably don't do any good at all. If I had to say to take away something, is that any time that you enter into a letter of intent, try to recognize that some parts of it are probably going to be non-binding and agree on which parts are non-binding without consents or approval or things like that. And then some things that would be would in fact be binding, a non-disclosure kind of provision, or agreements relating to the timelines. And but think through that, because if the whole thing is binding, then you may well have, depending on your state law, obviously. The letter of intent may constitute a binding contract to sell, and a court would find that way. And if you, the purchaser, for example, defaulted or didn't actually enter into a what I call a complete contract, you could be bound and be subject to either enforcement through specific performance or alternatively damages for not performing. I don't know that there's a good list of things to put in every letter of intent, but obviously timelines, who bears which cost, the things that are to be furnished, title, who buys title policy, who pays the broker, those sorts of things. The end result should be, I suppose, that you've got a general outline. The parties can say, okay, this is what we will work toward in terms of coming up with a mutually acceptable agreement that's signed by both parties, and to the extent a third party, like a board, is supposed to approve it, that's accomplished. The big no-no is to have an open-ended time period within which the parties are supposed to come to an agreement. Even if you establish a hard date by which you need to say that this agreement terminates if we don't reach an agreement that everybody is signed, sealed, and delivered by this hard date.
Yeah, by the way,
typically what happens is that the parties will continue negotiating past that deadline, and that automatically gets them into trouble. Go ahead, Dick.
A couple of suggestions. One, I would never call it an agreement.
Yeah, well,
yeah, because you don't want it to be. You only want it to be an agreement, really on the most important agreement that you can reach in a letter of intent is how long is that the seller will take it off the market, will not market it for an active period of days. You do put all the rest of the stuff in, but you will find that even the rest of the stuff you put in, including timelines, title, who pays for what, will probably get renegotiated to some degree in the contract of sale, and that's okay. Sure. The other important thing to put in there is that this agreement, except for the exclusivity period, is not binding on anybody. It is not a contract and will not result in a contract until the parties fully negotiate and execute a contract of sale which contains the appropriate commercial additions to the terms and conditions of the letter of intent. This is just simply an expression of intent, and you need to put that. You need to put that in there. There is a famous Connecticut case who's quite old and whose citation I've forgotten. That's the downside of over 40 years of practice. When I was younger, I could remember it. That really took a letter of intent and made it into a contract of sale because it contained enough conditions by which you can close. It identified the property. It had a price. It did not say it was not binding, and it was signed by both parties.
Yeah.
You know, it's enough to really kind of locate things. If you have the property in there described, and if you have the price in there described, you may just under the statute of frauds have arrived at a contract. So I think you need to be. The disclaimer is, without a doubt, the most important thing you need to put in every letter of intent.
Right. You made one good point about statute of frauds, which generally I try to avoid having applying by not putting a legal description in the letter of intent. Just refer it to the ABC building at such and such in Houston, Texas. Now, generally under Texas law, that's not sufficient. To invoke the statute of fraud, so you don't have a valid legal description.
Yeah, but check your state law, by all means.
I only practice in Texas. That's what I said.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying to the,
Texas,
yeah.
I don't know whether it works elsewhere.
Yeah, but for those of you who don't practice in Texas, check your state law, because it is really not so clear that you will, in fact, not create a binding contract. It varies from state to state. There is no one particular thing that you can point to that will or will not satisfy the statute of frauds. Because I would bet out of the 50 states, there are 51 interpretations.
Probably so.
Yeah, Tony, your experience with this.
I agree with everything that's been said, and the only other thing I would say for the benefit of practitioners is that my experience with letters of intent is a little different in the sense that people have a tendency, once that letter of intent is signed, to say that, okay, we've already agreed on the points that are in this letter of intent, and if additional issues come up underneath the subject headings of those different sections, people will sometimes try to guilt you or guilt your client into saying, well, you already agreed and now you're retrading.
Right.
So that to me has always been the big danger of the letter of intent is they, in effect, people start saying, well, you already agreed to this. Why are we still negotiating? And you say, well, we had a general understanding on this point, but we all knew that it was going to have a lot more detail. So try to be clear about that.
And by the way, I love the transaction where both parties say that about different sections.
Yes.
And that is not just a humorous remark, by the way. It's happened. Your client's point of view about a letter of intent is very simple. I want the letter of intent binding on them and not on me.
Right. Oh, yes.
So I find letters of intent to be... I've never not done them, and I've never liked them.
Yes,
because to some degree, I think they can prolong the negotiations.
Well, they get longer and cost you more money.
Yeah,
And one other,
you still don't have a deal at that point.
Sure. One other issue, Dick, worth noting, at least in Illinois, there's case law in Illinois that suggests, I don't know about other states, John or Dick, but... there is law out there that even if you say it is non-binding, and it says it explicitly on the face, if one party or the other starts relying on that letter of intent as if it was binding, and the other party knows that party is changing position and doing things entering into arrangements, you might find that detrimental reliance upon the letter of intent might turn it into a binding contract.
Yeah.
And there's case law on that, so I always usually put in there, I try to get something in the letter of intent that says either party you know, who takes action and relies on this, does so solely at their own risk, and the other party's not responsible.
That's a great point, Tony.
Litigate whether that works or not, but because you've got something to hang your hat on if you had a defense of it.
If you go back to contracts one, and you study the statute of fraud, detrimental reliance is the one extension, and I think that's a marvelous point to put in your letter of intent.
Yeah,
I think we've beaten letters of intent to death. Let's talk about special issues in income-producing property. Why are we singling it out? When you're buying land, you know, land is a much simpler task. Because we're going to talk about due diligence.
That's where you are.
Yeah, but let's talk about income producing property and due diligence and put this together. I think they almost belong together. You know, first of all, what is appropriate due diligence? Well, appropriate due diligence depends on what you're buying.
Right.
You know, the basics are there. The basics are, you know, you want title. And you certainly want, you want to be able to get good and marketable title. You want to be able to review the exceptions in your contract of sale. You know, obviously you want the right to, in order to perform, to object to certain exceptions and see if they can be removed. And then you'll make up your own mind. You will make up your own mind on which you would like, and then you'll see whether they can be removed or not. Zoning. You want to look and make sure that the property that you're buying is properly zoned. And if it's a variance or a special exception, what's the consequence of that in the jurisdiction in which you're doing business? And what happens, under those circumstances, and I really, if I'm buying, if I'm selling, I'm not going to. One thing I'm going to tell you is I ain't going to tell you what the zoning is. I won't represent it to you. You figure it out. When I buy, how do I figure it out? I do several things. The first thing I do is go to one of the zoning services and get a zoning report. By the way, those reports are really more consequences of the securitization market, because before that, you really didn't do it that way. A lot of these places didn't exist, but now the lender interest in securitization, you know, want to see a zoning report from somebody. But if I'm buying, I want to do more than that. Do I want an appropriate letter from the zoning people? Sure I do. Why not? For whatever it's worth. And it ain't worth much. I'll tell you that, because you have the concept, unless there is some kind of absolute detrimental reliance, which you find it difficult to prove, governments can't be stopped.
Correct.
So what they tell you, what they tell you is wrong, too bad. You can't do anything about it. There are no consequences. So the third thing I will do is get the zoning file and look at it. Either I'll have local counsel if it's far enough away, or I'll send somebody, or I'll go myself, and I want to look at the zoning file. I want to see what's there. I want to see from my own eyes and have my own local counsel begin to tell me what's there, you know, what it means, what's the consequences of being there. That may sound like overkill, but particularly if I'm buying an income-producing piece of property, I really do care, because that's the last thing in the world I need is a non-conforming use. So if the thing burns down and I can't rebuild it, I mean, I ran into a situation in Florida, for example. I was actually a lender, but it's the same principle, that they were in the Florida, they were within the distance of the Atlantic Ocean, where they could not rebuild an 18-story building any more than 12 stories. That really does seriously affect my security. Because
right.
I no longer have, and you know, and by the way, they mean that in Miami.
Yes.
they're not kidding. So therefore, I've lent you money on an 18-story residential you know, high rise that now becomes a 12-story residential high rise with no possibility of necessary. And I'm, by the way, I was a mezzanine lender, which even made it worse because there was no possibility of me ever recovering my, you know, my whatever you want to call it, equity, my loan amount. So you need to. The zoning examination is not just sitting there and waiting for somebody to send you something. I think it needs to be active if you're buying a piece of property. If you're selling, you know, you want to look and see what they get, but the last thing you ever do when you're a seller in zoning is open your mouth about anything, and you will not make a representation in the contract. Has that been your experience, folks? John and Tony?
Sure.
The
contract will probably say, I'm telling you nothing except with respect to things that are easily verifiable. As I say, I'm duly incorporated. Yeah. Here's a copy of my board resolution authorizing this, but I'm turning this property over for inspection. Whatever it is you want to go look at, as long as it's non-destructive and we don't violate any laws in conducting the due diligence work, and we certainly don't turn it out to the public. That would be one thing I want to be sure of, is that to the extent that you've got a piece of property that is, shall we say, attractive to a number of people, you certainly would like to keep, as a seller, keep all the information that you're providing to the prospective buyer as closely controlled as possible, so that other people don't have access to or the advantage of the information that's been made available or that will be made available about the property.
Yeah, I think and, one of the. Go ahead, Tony. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say you mentioned obtaining these zoning reports, and I just want to alert everyone when you go to get one of those. Be a little wary about relying on them, only because if you look at the fine print of the contract that you signed when you get those reports, John, I don't know, I've seen this over and over. Their liability is capped at the amount of the fee, which is usually $1,000 or $2,000. So, you know, we never just rely on that zoning report alone. We would do an independent evaluation.
Well, at least they're agreeing to be liable for some amount. You go to the zoning office or the permit office here in Houston, and there's a standard form. There's a pad, okay, and the guy signs his name at the bottom and hands it to you. He just says, what's the address? They fill in the blank. The guy signs it and gives it to you, and then, you know, the bottom of the page, it said, you know, this is all you're going to get. So it's a totally meaningless piece of paper.
Yeah, that's why, as I said, I go to the file.
Yeah, no, I understand that.
Got to go to the file. You got to look at it yourself.
Yeah.
If you're in a
have somebody who knows what they're doing.
Yeah. Right, if you're not, you know, obviously, if I was in Houston, which is does Houston have zoning, John?
Zoning. We have a whole series of land use regulations, which are very, very difficult to get any confirmation about from anybody other than someone who has spent their whole life.
Certainly, if I were going to do a deal in Houston, John, you'd be the first person I'd call.
Yeah, I would turn you over to somebody who knows how to get that information.
Yeah, so that's one aspect of it. Title, another important aspect. You need to get a title more than just a title report. I would say that getting a title report in a due diligence is the start, but you also would like to see a form of commitment. You would like to see what exceptions are going to be taken, and with the appropriate disclaimers that you will get from the title company, about the conditions that you have to satisfy. I like to get a title commitment, so at least I can see what the title company is going to do, because with a title report, they don't tell you what they're going to do. And therefore, I go to the commitment. I can at least, before I sign the contract, I know what I need to ask the other side to do, and I know what I need to ask the title company to do. So that goes without saying. Environmental, if you want to get any, you know, number one, if you ever want to get any money from a lender, and I would say that I've not done a lot of, I can't think of a single cash sale I've ever done.
You don't want to do one anymore, I can tell you that.
Well, yeah, well, including, I'm even including houses, which
yeah,
I don't
no,
do.
I
but
you cannot take money to the title company anywhere,
yeah.
any place, anymore.
That's true. That is true. But
yeah.
but the point being that you
no, I know what your point.
Yeah, you've got to get an environmental report. Got to get at least a phase one.
Yeah.
Phase one is a very very, well, I wouldn't even call it very detailed. It will give you the history of the property, and give you any known conditions that. That are available through the public records. We will talk about representations and warranties
yeah.
tomorrow.
Before you leave environment, let me just make a quick comment
yeah.
there. It's not unusual that a lot of times a seller will offer the buyer, as part of the due diligence, reports that the seller has obtained previously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay. And environmental is usually one. In fact, most buyers will, the lawyers would say, I want to know what these prior reports said, just so if I'm in the midst of a quagmire now, maybe I just want to abandon this thing. But the important thing is a buyer cannot rely on most of these prior reports, including without limitation the environmental, without a reliance letter from the professional that did the inspection, the environmental report. The same would go with surveys and a lot of other things. So if you're being offered copies of prior reports and you want to rely on them, then you've got to bargain for and usually pay for the reliance certificate.
But I would prefer
no,
to
I know.
Do
you
two.
Would
I would prefer to do, actually, I would suggest to my client they do both.
Well, that's probably
get
that's
whatever
what
reports
I mean,
they do and pay for the reliance letter and then do their own independent study.
I would agree because you can compare and contrast and say, okay, 2 years ago they found nothing and now
yeah.
you've got something. This didn't happen because you guys are only running a business that doesn't generate this kind of stuff. Who made a mistake?
The interesting part about it is that as a seller, I might get an environmental report and get a reliance letter that I'll pay for and show. But it depends on how quickly
yeah, no,
things happen.
It's all about time. It's all about
and we'll talk about it in reps and warranties. But I'm going to give you a preview. You don't get very much from the seller,
right?
So you really do need to deal with reports. Let's now move into I now practice in Philadelphia, the only land you can buy are parking lots. There's not and you can buy some vacant torn down land from the city. But when I was with the Rouse Company in Columbia, Maryland, we were building super regional malls. We bought land. But for the most part, my experience has been buying income-producing properties of all kinds, hotels, office buildings, residential, and, of course, shopping centers of all shapes, sizes, and varieties. And I've never bought an industrial park, thank goodness. But when you're dealing with an income-producing property, and I'll also extend this over to land, what kind of due diligence do you really go through? You go through a much, much more exhaustive due diligence when you're buying an income-producing property. What is it that you want to see? And again, we'll couple this back to warranties and representations tomorrow. But the important thing is that what you want to see is every piece of paper that could possibly encumber the real estate. You want all the leases, you want all the title documents, you want to see all site agreements between tenants and landlords. You want, and above all, I will always go in with a team of people and look at files. I want to see the actual files that the landlord has with respect to every tenant and every other income-producing or expense-producing agreement that they've entered into. Because the simple reading of the leases doesn't help you very much. It helps you in understanding the terms, but you don't know if there might be some modification stuck in there that is not part of the lease that they're not telling you about. And what you want to really develop is a totally accurate economic prediction of what you, the buyer, are going to be able to obtain out of this, including opportunities. And by opportunities, I mean, you know, it's very, very nice to buy an existing shopping center and watch it just sit there. But when I worked for a company that bought shopping centers, we only bought them for opportunities. We bought them to be able to improve the cash flow and thus be able to improve the value of the center. And we were not big sellers, but we were publicly traded and we were in the forefront. We were the first company that did current value accounting, which before REITs was the only way you could really get an accurate measure of a real estate company, because real estate companies always show terrible balance sheets because there's depreciation. And they didn't show actual value of a piece of real estate. They showed the cost, less depreciation. So real estate companies always were negative, and nobody could quite understand them until the Securities and Exchange Commission came to the company I worked for and said, we're going to let you try an experiment, which became the way things worked from about 1983 to 1993 in the real estate world, which was current value accounting. In other words, you could get appraisals and use the appraisals as an alternate balance sheet that actually showed the real worth of the property, not generally accepted accounting principal worth of the property, which didn't even come close, you know, to a successful project. And by the way, also didn't come close to a drastically unsuccessful property, because they were worth less than the current value. The current value, you know, they were worth less than the depreciated value. So, but what you want to do is you want to confirm the economic terms. Why? I look at real estate as being one thing, as income producing real estate as being one thing. It's the right, everything that I'm looking at, with the exception of the leases and the things that produce money, are all encumbrances and detriments. I own a building, it means I may have to fix it. I own a building, and even though I depreciate it in accordance with GAAP, I have to fix it. It's an expense. I have to mow the grass. It's an expense. I own this land. It's wonderful. If I don't have, the only thing I'm buying is the right to receive income from the property, either as situated or as I envision it. And so therefore, I really need to very, very carefully and with great particularity look at everything in connection with that. And that does not mean just reading leases. That means doing a couple of other things. It means doing, you know, diligence. It may mean in the letter of intent that you need to get permission to talk to tenants, because I think it's not a wise maneuver to sit down and pick up the phone and call a tenant and without the landlord's permission. That could lead to a very, very interesting, you know, interference with economic relations lawsuit. You need to make sure that the income that you expect to get and the income that you hope to get by doing things to the property, like getting rid of tenants, relocating tenants, all can come to fruition as a result of your examination of all the income-producing items, which are not just the documents. This is going to lead to a rapid warranty that we'll talk about tomorrow. But above all, in your own head, you want to make sure that your client's dream is realizable. What are your thoughts about that?
I can't argue with
well,
that.
No, Dick, that's absolutely spot on. The couple of comments on that, I would say, especially for lawyers, what tends to happen, and John, I don't know how things work in your firm, but I can tell you over years of experience, what tends to happen is the task of reading the leases is sort of something that gets delegated to younger lawyers, typically staffing a transaction, especially a larger transaction, if it's a big office building or a big industrial building or something like that, multi-tenant. And so I always tell the young lawyers, don't just read the lease for, you know, to make sure that there's a term and when the term ends and check out the terms that are on the rent roll against the lease terms. Be on the lookout for some real trouble clauses. One of them is early termination rights. One of them is obligation to pay a broker upon a renewal. Another one, there's a lot of hidden clauses in a lease, as you guys know, where you could end up having expenses associated with the lease which may not have been scheduled. And if the client is relying on the law firm for the review of the leases and a memo summarizing what their obligations are, particularly when you're working with the younger lawyers, they may not have enough experience to realize that that renewal clause may carry with it an obligation to pay a broker on a renewal.
Correct.
The early termination clause, you know, is obviously a serious risk. Another one that I find, you know, trips people up all the time is periodic obligation to paint or recarpet the space. That can be a hidden expense, and those clauses are not always, you know, in a clause that says at the heading, note to reviewing party, there is a hidden expense buried in here.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to read the damn thing and, you know, pay attention to it. And it's not my number one fear, actually, in handling these transactions is when they try to delegate, you know, due diligence to the law firm. And now lawyers are taking on that liability. You know, if that lease has a expense provision in there and you don't call that to the client's attention, you know, you may have just committed malpractice. So when you've got a bunch of these leases, one of the worst nightmares of my career is we had a client once who bought, there was a company that owned the restaurants at airports all over the country. And our client was buying that company, and we had to read, I think it was 75 airport leases in about a week and a half. And, you know, we were all petrified that, you know, those – because you know about airport – if anybody's not familiar, airport leases are very complicated, difficult documents.
We represented the Philadelphia airport retail people. And every lease is required to contain a cancellation clause if the government chooses to, FAA chooses to have you cancel it. You talk about scary business.
Yeah.
I never known it to happen, by the way. Probably has.
But it's out there. It's lurking.
Yeah.
So I agree with everything that's been said about the due diligence process. One other issue that we like to tell the clients to be sure and be alert for, particularly in smaller, maybe less sophisticated clients on an income-producing property. I think biggest single risk to the income, future income stream is deferred maintenance. That is not a legal issue, obviously, but I like to always tell the client, listen, make sure that you've had a thorough inspection by a good quality mechanical engineer and a HVAC company or something, because that deferred maintenance is what really causes a lot of properties to not perform. Again, you buy the property, you get in there, and you find out that the prior owner had the boiler system held together with chewing gum and baling wire, and now you got to replace the boiler or something like that. So sometimes the best advice you may give is not purely legal advice.
Yeah. And by the way, that is another due diligence item, which you always should do, and that is a complete structural inspection and, of course, a survey. And my remarks about the surveyor was not meant to demean the surveying profession. They just take a long time to in a busy climate, and you want the right surveyor, you may be the 49th person on the list when you want 30 days to close. Those are all very, very important due diligence items, because I think it also bears out what I said before, which is very, very simple, that the only thing that means anything to you is the money that comes in. The rest of it is all an expense. It's really nice if you've ever owned your own house, you know what I'm talking about. I live in a condo, and people get, they think they live in apartments, and they get surprised when we get assessments. But such is life.
Pump the water out of the basement, right?
Well, it's even worse. I'm the president of the condo association, so I have to sneak in and out of my apartment. But
what lapse of sanity led you to become president of the?
Oddly enough, the first year the firm wouldn't let me do it because we represent condo developers. Second year, they said it was okay. I went to the first year's bunch of meetings and determined that for self-defense, I'd better be on the board. And then they elected me president. And it's been 12 years. And trust me, it is self-defense. Because I have four other people who are very nice people. They're good friends. They're wonderful people. They know about as much about buildings as I do about building a nuclear device. As a matter of fact, they probably know less about the building than I know about, nuclear devices. But let us move on because we have a couple things we need to cover in a short period of time. Deposits of money. What's been your experiences?
Don't let the other side's lawyer hold the money. I can tell you that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's usually, title companies will hold the money, or banks will hold the money. There's a fee, but for example, my firm would never. We're not permitted to hold escrows.
No, we don't either.
Yeah, it's just something you don't do.
I've noticed also recently that at least down here, smaller title companies, you get a little nervous about what they are doing with the handling of the deposits, and so sometimes we go to, let's just say, the next tier up in terms of the title company's organization,
mm-hmm.
and use maybe the state office or the regional office to accept and hold the deposits,
right.
because you're not really confident that in a small town or a small county that everybody's handling the stuff like they're supposed to. Not necessarily anybody's committing fraud. They're just not handling it the way it should be handled.
Yep.
And the banks, you may get in trouble with the bank. You may get in trouble with the title company. So you're trying to move to not necessarily a money center, but let's say I'd probably rather do business with a major title company office in Houston as opposed to one 100 miles away in a smaller county.
Well, when it was my choice, I'd never used agencies.
Yeah, definitely.
I went direct to one of the big four or five title companies.
Right.
Again, I agree with you completely that if my client has an agency they love or it's their brother-in-law, I will insist that the issuer of the policy be the holder. About deposits, the interesting discussion about deposits is when do they get put up, how do they get put up, and how do you get access to them? And, typically speaking, in most contracts of sale, when the contract of sale, you see a deposit of some kind, but after the due diligence procedure is over and the parties agreed to go forward, I normally see a significant increase in the amount of the deposit. And because that means you now have a binding contract of sale, and once the binding contract of sale, once the due diligence period is over, I want more money in there. I don't need to have money in there, as much money in there. I want enough money in there to make sure they do their thing. But on the other hand, typically speaking, at the end of a due diligence period, if they say no, they get their money back. Unless it's a very, very frothy market. On the other hand, once the due diligence period is over and they say, let's go ahead, I see significant increases in deposits. Has that been your experience?
Yes. Yes.
Absolutely, yeah. And I always tell people, listen, the deposit that is posted during the due diligence period is meaningless because the other side can walk from it. So who cares whether it's $10 or $100,000 or a million?
It's got to be at least a dollar and other good and valuable.
Yeah.
Right. Unless you have worries about the financial ability of the buyer to perform, I guess you might want to see some early money. But
yeah,
it's once the contract, as we say, goes hard and there are no further conditions that the failure of which would let the buyer get their money back, that's when you want some substantial earnest money to justify all the costs that your seller side is incurring. Dick, one thing I wanted to mention on this deposit topic that I think might be particularly useful, and I don't know about you guys, people become very casual and cavalier about wire transferring money.
Yeah.
And, you know, because it just used to be it would take several days to accomplish it, and the banks would play games, they would hold your money overnight and all this kind of nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems to have been cleared out. The wire transfer system works pretty efficiently nowadays. The problem is the fraud issue, and
right.
I am aware of instances where people have had their computers hacked and wire transfer instructions got sent to the wrong party and so forth. So, number one, I want to encourage everybody who's listening, if you're sending wire transfer instructions, try to call and follow up and make sure that the right instructions got to where they were going.
Right.
And secondly, on the wire transfer front, want to remind everybody there's law out there, and in the Seventh Circuit in particular, that says that if you have a time is of the essence clause, it is the duty of the wiring party to get it there on time. And if it gets, you know, I find that people have a tendency to think they can send these wires, John and Dick, at 1 in the afternoon, and it's going to get there in time. You know what? If you don't get that money there on the closing day, the other side declares you in default and wants to forfeit your earnest money and go sell the property to somebody else because they got a better offer. You're in default in the Seventh Circuit, at least. If your money didn't get there on time, even if it's the fault of the bank or the title company couldn't find it, you're out. And so be very careful about those wire transfers.
I try to do one thing in the contract. I will never put in the word time or essence, even if they're in the front and the back.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate time and the essence clauses because they really just haunt you. And they are not favorable. They are probably not favorable to either party, but particularly to a buyer. The last subject we have to do today is financing contingencies. In a frothy market, I don't see a lot of financing contingencies. What about you guys?
That's true. I mean, I guess if the real issue here is I might give you some amount of time, say, you know, during the due diligence period, you got to get satisfied on financing as well, and the buyer runs the risk that you can't get it done at that point in time, and so, you know, the deal doesn't get done.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest problem that I encounter on the, if there are any contingencies, is that the lender may want more due diligence than is scheduled for the contract, or may want let's say that environmental report comes back and they say, oh, well, I see this and this, so that always leads me to go, I need another trip to the property, bore some holes, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
The lender requirements will not mesh with, a lot of times, with the due diligence, either in type and time. And so that is really a risk of losing the deal.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're having financing at all. So and lenders, obviously, are not going to waive some of the things that are the protections for them, i.e., not just environmental, but every lender has a hot button somewhere on the list of things that they tick off in terms of making a loan, and generally that means it'll go. You know, loan commitments don't exist anymore. They just simply say, okay, here are the loan documents. You get them signed. Dot all the I's, cross all the T's, and we close. We're not issuing you any commitment. It closes when it closes, and all of our requirements have been satisfied. And So that is a tough row to hoe for somebody who's got earnest money at risk. And I've seen a lot of situations where you know, the earnest money's gone hard and they still don't have a deal with the lender, and you're running up to the 11th hour before the scheduled closing date, and at serious risk of losing a bunch of money.
Yeah, one area you do tend to see them still nowadays, guys, is if you're buying a multifamily property and it has some sort of a HUD financing vehicle on it, not unusual to take subject to that, and then you got to go get a HUD consent to the transfer.
Yes.
Right. And all I can tell you is if you find yourself in one of those deals, whatever they tell you, however long they tell you it's going to take,
it'll take twice.
Long.
Right.
And cost more.
Yeah, the Fannie Freddie deals are, you know, you just have to take that into consideration. But in the end, they are typically given. I've seen them turned down, but it's not customary. Well, I think we're out of time for today. Sorry, that's my cell phone, which keeps annoying me. Operator, could you please give instructions as to how our listeners can ask some questions?
If you wish to ask a question, please press the star key on your touch-tone phone, followed by the 1 key. That's star 1. When you do, you will be told your place in line. To get out of the queue, press the pound key. When prompted for your question, please be brief.
Thank you. I have a question while we're waiting for questions. How many in the deals that you've done, and I'll talk about deals I've done, I assume you find it customary at the end of a due diligence process for there to be any number of objections. I view the new due diligence processes as the way to rebid the property frequently, and I have clients who do that. What's been your experience?
There's always something that will cause the buyer to tense up, or the buyer's lawyer to tense up and say, you know, this is a bridge too far. Whether it's a major lease that has a provision in it that says, you know, this is going to happen, or I can think of shopping centers where there's a provision for co-tenancies, and he's saying, oh, I found this out, and this guy is, he's leaving tomorrow. And so I got to have some relief from the domino effect of the co-tenancy clause.
Mm-hmm.
These things. So we need to talk about what we're going to pay for this.
Tony, your feelings?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think most sophisticated sellers now expect there to be some retrading that occurs during the due diligence period. And that's why a better negotiation is one in which you've identified the issues to the buyer, and you tell them, listen, when you get in here, here's what you're going to find, A, B, C, D, and E.
Mm-hmm.
You go evaluate it. You figure it out. But I'm telling you now, don't come back. We've already priced it to take these into account.
Yeah.
And even after you tell them that, guess what happens?
They're going to come back.
Okay.
They come back.
That's right. They do come back. And I've never seen one where there wasn't a comeback. It just has never happened. Operator, do we have any questions from the audience?
There are no questions at this time.
Well, then, thank you, everyone, for listening. We're out of time. We hope we can speak with you again tomorrow. If you are not able to ask your questions or if one occurs to you, you have our three contact information in your material. This is Dick Goldberg on behalf of John Hollifield and Tony Licata. Thank you for joining us.
On behalf of the Professional Education Broadcast Network, thank you for listening. This concludes today's teleseminar.